Welcome to episode 30 of Redesigning Cities, the Speedwell Foundation Talks at Georgia Tech. I'm Ellen Dunham-Jones, Director of the MS in Urban Design at Georgia Tech and the host of this series. Today, I have the pleasure of speaking with Kai Uwe Bergman, partner at BIG, the Bjarke Ingels Group based in Copenhagen. Superstars, they have been spreading their innovative, award-winning, hedonist sustainability design ideas across the globe. Kai Uwe runs the New York office, oversees the firm's urban scale and landscape projects, and is the 2023 Portman Prize Studio Critic at Georgia Tech, where he's challenging 78 Master of Architecture students to reimagine social infrastructure. Kai Uwe, I love the provocation that you've challenged the students with, but before we go there, give our listeners a little background. Why don't you start by telling us, where did you grow up? What were the different cities that you've lived in? And how have they influenced how you think about design of buildings and of infrastructure?
Thank you very much for the invitation, Ellen. And really looking forward to uncover what we mean by social infrastructure and what that means to our cities. I think my upbringing is one of many different perspectives. And I say that because I was born in a relatively small German city called Einbeck, about 20,000 inhabitants, but one that is built of these wonderful timber frame homes from the 16 and 1700s. So there isn't an immediate kind of historic quality of preserving, rehabilitating, reusing. The buildings there are lived in and used much differently than they were first built for. So that adaptive kind of way of a city being able to expand and to retract and to remold itself is something that has always stuck with me. Then at age 6, my family actually immigrated to the United States. And I came over on the Queen Elizabeth II ocean liner from the UK. And the first sight I had of the United States was the Statue of Liberty. And it was 1976, so it was a very patriotic period, the 200th anniversary of the founding of the United States. So I was introduced to the skyline of New York. We then moved to a small mill town in rural Georgia, LaGrange, Georgia, which is about just an hour south of here in Atlanta. And again, in a smaller setting, I was really beginning to understand sort of American values and was understanding how the community is set up there. Those two cities of Einbeck and LaGrange left that early impression. What my family did at that time, too, was travel. So we took every opportunity to go and see places. And I started to realize that I wanted to become an architect after visiting all of these cathedrals, after seeing all of these sort of castles and forts and boulevards and plazas. It was at that moment, kind of in my mid-teenage years, that I was looking for universities that would offer me that chance. And so we met at the University of Virginia in Charlottesville.
Yes, we did.
Where Thomas Jefferson built a kind of ideal location of what an academic village could become. So I would say that that's how I grew to really build my own values of how to build community.
It's a wonderful story. I knew nothing about you coming and seeing the Statue of Liberty, and it's such a vivid image.
Yes.
So those experiences and what you're describing about sort of how a community adapts with its existing buildings and modifies, you know, over time how they're using them starts to get us, I think, a little bit more into the discussion about social infrastructure. So first thing I want to ask about that is, do you see social infrastructure as a single thing like daycare, a library, a school? Those are typical programs that sometimes are thought of as social infrastructure. Or, as I suspect, do you see it more in terms of combining two things, as in adding the ski slope to the power plant at Copenhill or adding recreation spaces to the Big U storm surge infrastructure around Lower Manhattan?
Well, I would go back a little further and say that the word infrastructure in the American sort of parlance or how it is used probably in modernism became disconnected from the architectural realm and became more of a engineering kind of realm. So when roads started to sort of be disassociated with the buildings or the plots of land that they were building in, and they were seen as more moving people from point A to point B. You had the huge dam projects. You had, you know, water management ideas. You had infrastructure became, I think, disconnected from social needs. And so it became just how could we design the infrastructure most efficiently? And in many ways, it scaled as the population scaled. But we can see now in the last sort of 60 to 80 years reflecting back that those decisions were often made without the social qualities as an important factor. Because the social factors were deprioritized, this has now been the legacy that we've inherited. So I think our ideas of social infrastructure are re-establishing a connection between social values and infrastructure so that when decisions are made about infrastructure, they actually bring those two parts together.
I couldn't agree more. Way back when I was one of your teachers in Charlottesville, Jude LeBlanc, another one of your teachers at UVA at the time, Jude and I had managed to wheedle our way into having some modest say in the redesign of a bridge that formed the eastern entrance to the city over the Rivanna River. And I wrote a letter at the time. It was really an article, an op-ed for Architecture Magazine. I framed it as a letter to mayors. Don't leave the design of infrastructure solely to the engineers. Much of it has a public space function, and some of it's underground and isn't per se, but it all is has this opportunity. It needs the input of civic-minded architects to get it to double function with social purpose, with even sort of contextual purposes of relating to that specific environment and city. And it seems to me so many of Big's innovations spring from that same impulse of making practical things like roofs or grounds double purpose. Roofs you can ski on, cladding almost made out of birdhouses, highway intersections becoming a concert hall, or shipping containers becoming floating dorm rooms. Tell us about how those ideas, how do you curate those ideas, brainstorm those kinds of ideas, find the amazing ways you guys have integrated double functioning elements into your work?
Yeah, so there's a lot of that duality, or we would call sort of hybrid programs. But if we go also back to the idea of this disconnected infrastructure to its social kind of surroundings, think about how infrastructure is often shown on a map. They're shown as gray areas that are completely roped off from their surroundings. A power plant can be positioned in the center of a city, but no one's allowed near it. You could also say the same about railway infrastructure, or there are these areas in cities where that disconnect, that kind of either a scar or entire sort of blacked out space, that is one that we feel there are great potentials, if thought through, that would allow to re-enter these areas and reconnect those areas with their surroundings. There still can be areas that are, you know, off limits because of safety issues, but think of a power plant and then think of one that you can inhabit the entire roof of. There still is the whole guts of the building that function as the power plant, but making a power plant completely accessible 24/7 and being able to kind of now start to think of the programs that would make this power plant attractive to all of the surrounding residents. You're taking something that was, for, you know, a NIMBY project, and you're turning it into a YIMBY project. Yes, I want that power plant in my backyard. And I think that those, we're continuously trying to find the programs that are lacking in a particular neighborhood. And then we're finding ways to actually co-fund or to find ways to energize each of those through the other. And I would also say again that there are a lot of silos that we have built structurally, either within the way that the agencies work to approve things or the way that building departments permit things. And it's a very zonal world out there. And I think that what we try to do with the projects is to look for cross-collaboration between public agencies, between building departments, and seeing the potential that you can actually create with a bit more complexity and risk, but the benefits far outweigh what those risks might be.
The Copenhill project is really exceptional, and I can only imagine what those meetings were like. Some of the first when you proposed, you know, hey, Copenhagen's this really flat landscape. We don't have any hills. We don't certainly don't have any place to go skiing. And yet this power plant gives us an opportunity to create an artificial ski slope year round on the grass. I mean, it's such a fantastic idea. And exactly as you said, it's something now that people want in their neighborhood because you're also cleaning it up and making it beautiful.
So many people always ask us, how did you convince the client to do something like this? And it does take clients who can see that potential and that vision. And in this case, the director of the power plant did. But she said something that was very interesting in that what she saw was that she has an annual budget in her current power plant that deals with the legal issues that current residents are continuously bringing up because they don't want to have the power plant. So she pays lawyers to maintain the power plant. By actually creating a power plant that people could see a benefit to their own lives, you no longer are paying lawyers to deal with all of the friction. You've eliminated the friction, and you can spend the money that you do on lawyers on the actual programming of the ski slope and of the climbing wall and all of the other programs. So she literally just took money that she was spending anyways and applied it to some place that gave way more benefit to the residents.
So another example, and I'd love to hear you just describe it a little more for our listeners. In Prague, the Philharmonic. So describe that site and how you transformed that one.
Well, the Philharmonic is a site that has, and there are many sites like it in cities around the world. So it's on the Vltava River. And it's a site that has, because of successive decisions on sort of roads and the placement of roads adjacent to the river and where, you know, this is a site that has just been basically cut off from most or all parts of the city because of the emphasis on mobility and sort of cars. And it's a prime location within the city. So the city has been really spending a decade or more trying to figure out what can we do there and how can we restitch things together. And by the proposal, it's as much an urban proposal as it is to find a home for these four wonderful performance spaces. And we really looked at solving the issues of the urban restitching. And so with each of the theaters, we built, I would say, you know, cascading landscape of plinths and terraces and really offered people a view that, like the Charles Bridge, which is also a place that all visitors and citizens of Prague go to, they see their cities in a way and views of the city that they can only get from the Charles Bridge. We believe that we're going to have a very similar experience here, and you're literally rising to the height of the spires that are around you. So by the time that you reach the top, you are a part of that wonderful skyline of Prague as well.
So what did you do with all the road space for the cars?
It's really looking and remapping. The roads were built by, again, traffic engineers without thinking what and how that land should be accessible and valuable to the city. It was in the center, but then it's cut off and becomes an island. So we just, you know, again, need to, when thinking about these decisions of where roads go and the width of them, the curb cuts, all of these little minutiae of sort of thinking, we need to then continuously ask the question, what happens to these plots or these sites that are adjacent to them? So with that, I think there's still the ability to deal with the movement. We, of course, had to sort of realign a couple of the streets, but it's still there. It still functions. People can still come and go. But we have elevated the site.
Absolutely. You know, and I love seeing, it's incredible how much space we give, not just to cars for parking, but all the space that we give for high-speed geometries of roads. The land could be put to such more important U. So I love seeing those kinds of projects. Tell us also a little more about the Big U in Lower Manhattan. That's a pretty signature project and is under construction. And how is it evolving?
To really understand the Big U, I think you go all the way back to Bjarke's first project, which is the Copenhagen Harbor Baths. And it too is a piece of hedonistic sustainability in that you took a river, a canal in Copenhagen's case, that was, you know, dirty and that through 100 years plus of industry had been unusable other than a lane of traffic for boats. And the city decided to move the industry out of the heart and then to clean the water. And to celebrate the clean water, they built a 200,000 euro bathing platform. But this simple little bathing platform changed the perception of the 500,000 residents of what that part of Copenhagen could become. Suddenly it went from a back channel to the front door. And I think we see the same ability with the Big U when, you know, Manhattan's coastline has been under constant evolution for the last 400 to 500 years of being found as Manhattan, this land, this peninsula. And that over those years of sort of growth as a city, as a coastline, as a seafaring city, we see it now needing to prioritize these social functions as well as the industrious ones or, you know, economic ones. That we can, by thinking of a working waterfront, but one that also is there to protect and to provide that element of play as well and programming. So we think of it as a long line. It's 10 miles in length from East 23rd all the way down the tip of the Battery up to West 57th. This is the sort of geological kind of area that has been filled in the most and therefore is most susceptible to flooding. And we're raising that edge. And by raising the edge, we're creating, I still see it as a keystone, because we will need to probably build on that edge over successive generations. This is the first kind of effort to build that keystone that then allows for the programming, the social benefits. And again, all we did was ask the residents, what are you missing? We got a long laundry list of, we would love more playgrounds, or we need a senior center, or we need this, we need that. We prioritized those needs. And then we saw how federal funds for roads, bridges, and tunnels could be used to actually provide those types of programs to the community. The community then supports that work because they see a benefit in the 99% of the time where it's dry and it's not flooding, those programs will benefit the community. But then when you actually have an event of a storm or you have sea level rise, you're protected against those events. And I think that that's, again, a way of thinking about investing billions of dollars, but with people in mind.
The responsiveness to the community, I mean, all of this is extremely responsible, responsive, and nimble, and pulling all these things together. And it's, I know it's hard work, but what comes across so often, I think, in Big's designs is that you rework a lot of these conventional building typologies, or in this case, reworking conventional storm surge infrastructure, and you infuse it with a sense of joy, often a surprising playfulness, these community-driven programs that, you know, we just don't always see tied in with infrastructure. It's almost like instead of, you know, we've had the 1% for art program for years, but that in general kind of tacked on art, it didn't really integrate it as well. It's spending money on the social infrastructure and not just the utilitarian infrastructure. So in what ways, how have you been able to convince clients to put foot the bill for the joy?
I think really wonderful to hear you say that joy and the fun qualities also are seen, because I think that there's a big emphasis to, Bjarke, in his own words, would say, whenever we're being able to make a proposal, we should always consider what the gift can be to the city or to its citizens, to to the inhabitants. And I think this idea of giving gifts that become more than answering briefs is a very important element. And form giving, the last exhibition, is going deeper into how each project is providing and what the essential gift is. So, and those are often about the quality of life. And that we can talk a lot about climate change and we can talk a lot about the goals that we need to reach. But if we, at the very essential level, do not provide a higher quality of life, the move to those kind of goals becomes harder. If everyone can see a higher quality of life with more sustainable choices, they will more quickly move into that direction. So we're, with these projects, also trying to state that your lives will be improved or you will feel more daylight on your skin if you live in an affordable housing project where the ceilings are suddenly like 2 feet, 3 feet higher than typical. And these are qualities that are around us every single day. It's capturing them. It's, I think, spatializing them and putting them into the projects. And then showing how the life is better off. We spend a lot of time explaining, presenting ideas to clients. And, you know, just as anyone else, they're driven by budgets. They're driven by, you know, laws and regulations. But, you know, I'll take one example. The Light and Air Building Code of New York City is one that is over 100 years old, 1916, the first building code in the United States. And it was basically to get away from building like Lower Manhattan, these huge, tall buildings that had canyons and no light. They were windswept at the base. And over this last century, New York has developed into a better city because of that law. However, it's very prescriptive. So you end up with very similar buildings everywhere. I think you can still look at a law like the 1916 code and find new inventive ways of interpreting it. So we have two projects, the Smile, which is a project in Harlem, a residential project, where we scallop the facade so that the same amount of daylight is captured, but we do so to actually increase the amount of square footage at higher levels so it doesn't look like a wedding cake. And the Spiral is a high-rise now completing in New York, and that is terracing up landscape balconies all the way up to 1,000 feet. So rather than, again, having these wedding cake projects become kind of the answer to the law, it's actually reinterpreting these laws and regulations and finding ways to infuse them with better qualities of light, more outdoor space, more, you know, landscaping, biophilic elements. These are all possible, even within the laws that we have today.
Oh, and I think the court scraper. Yes. Is an amazing example already built there in New York of taking a typology of a skyscraper, but essentially now making a courtyard that is, I don't know how many stories tall, extremely sculptural. So it's really sculpting that communal space, not only sculpting kind of the solid object, but you're definitely bring those surprises and the joy. It's wonderful to hear you talk about it. Does playfulness scale? There's a saying, cute ages poorly. Kind of, can the playfulness, does it work best at the scale of an individual major space or the scale of an entire building or the scale of an entire city? And you guys are starting to really work on some big projects now.
The risks that are associated with some of these visions or designs as they become larger. I don't feel that playfulness needs to, or the gift that one is giving needs to be somehow lessened or somehow more serious as you go up in scale. There is scale and then questions of complexity because, you know, we're also making a proposal to put a habitation on the moon. And it may not be our biggest project, but it certainly would be the biggest challenge of actually building something in a zero gravity environment. And that, I think, still possesses a similar kind of approach to, well, if there is no gravity or there's a low gravity, then perhaps you can start to look at a single story as actually 2 to 3 floors tall because you can actually leap to get something off the top shelf. And that opens up an entirely new way of thinking about space sectionally. Now, thinking about scale in terms of, say, buildings to cities, a project like Tolosa is perhaps one that also gets a lot of, you know, opinions.
Describe what Tolosa is for our audience.
So Tolosa is a vision from Mark Laurie, who we've been working with now for a few years. And it is based on a principle of equitism that cities today are very much capitalized. You are either the have or the have not. The cities in Atlanta is a great example, just outside the doors here, of people who don't have the same rights, the same paths to independence and to making the choices that they wish to make. So equitism is a model where you don't own what, you know, something or have a 30-year mortgage on something. You literally share within a kind of mutual ownership, and the profits that this city is making is also divided among all of its residents and citizens.
And it's an entirely new city.
Entirely new city, up to 5 million, but it, of course it would grow from, say, an initial sort of 5 to 50,000 to 100,000 to larger. And when you look at the history of America and the kind of growth in those early kind of days and years, new cities being planned all over. But really in the last 60 to 70 years, not much has been shown in terms of a vision. Cities like Las Vegas or Phoenix have developed quite often without any vision. They just kind of grow informally. So this is a desire to kind of offer another vision, which Mark feels is what Americans did very well and much of in 100 years ago, and would like to bring that thinking back. And so there are limits to what you can do or show at that stage, just like Frank Lloyd Wright's Broadacre City showed a vision of the future. But of course, there's still a lot of answers or unanswerable comments. So I think it's something that you need to sort of experience and ask the questions. One needs to find what, if this is built by the people for the people, what do the people want? And those initial pioneers of Mark's vision would very much always be working on and tweaking what we've shown thus far.
It really is interesting. I think your point also that we just don't seem to be producing those visions for the long-term future. There's entire books, John Reps have collected all of those old aerial drawings that architects and planners did of the new cities planned in the West. And you see a few buildings in a couple of blocks in the, you know, early 1830s, 40s, but they have the street grids already planned. Manhattan, the street grid was planned all the way up the island when the buildings were still down at the very tip, 1808. I mean, we used to literally at least plan the infrastructure of the streets and of the property. So the equitism idea as a different kind of reinvention, and I hope it is successful and it does introduce a sense of, let's say, shared play and shared investment. It's a fascinating idea. We'll be looking to see where that one goes. It's exciting that the scope and scale that you guys are taking on now, working on the moon, and then Bjarke presented, and I want to encourage listeners to also be able to see the visions of all these projects that we've been talking about by watching the video of Bjarke's lecture, where he focused also on this, the plan for the planet. How do you expand these ideas of sort of hedonist sustainability, of equity, to at the scale really of the entire planet? And I think there were lots of really interesting ideas. I love the idea of just simply, can we figure out how to make a global energy grid that would distribute? So if you're producing solar on the part of the planet that's in daylight, it can also go to help the parts of the planet that are at night or east, west, and all of those kinds of things. Tell me a little about, what do you see as the biggest obstacles at this point to achieving this kind of planetary sustainability? Is it that we don't have a vision, literally, and that that's what you guys are providing? Or is it all the legal property rights, the culture wars, the fundamental inequities? I mean, just all the different.
As architects, we are ones who can provide visions and can coalesce conversations and find communities that support those visions. I do feel that, you know, what is typically the kind of frictions that you come against are political processes because the political spectrum can change with each election. So the decisions made in one cycle could be undone in the next cycle. So you're constantly kind of going through, you know, you need to create visions that the different political spectrums can resonate around. So the big U started in the Bloomberg administration, has gone through 8 years of the de Blasio administration, has now just been inherited by the Adams administration. And before it will be built, another 3 to 4 administrations will go through. So imagine that kind of project would need to actually be accepted and supported by 7 to 8 political perspectives. And it needs to be changing to the needs of each administration. So it makes you realize that Central Park is a phenomenal outcome of a similar kind of process. And that's what we need to consider always, is that you need to consider that larger arc that allows you to align a vision and make it something that's not, it's not about authorship or yours, it's everyone. And it needs to be able to be tweaked. The other kind of challenge and friction, I think, is, believe it or not, something like insurance. What is insurable? And insurance doesn't like risk. But being innovative is meaning that you're going someplace that you've never been. So you can't prove or show kind of outcomes. You have to create something that is achievable, people willing to take a leap of faith, and you do it in incremental steps. It's very hard to do in giant kind of leaps. And so that, I think, is the other one where, believe it or not, an insurance company may not want for you to create a collective flood management system for Manhattan, because then they don't sell flood insurance to the individual landholders or sites. So if it's in their interest to continuously flood and have people have to pay for the insurance to prevent the floodable occurrence, they're doing the math to figure out which of those scenarios is best for them. So it doesn't make sense. And so you do sometimes also go against what is maybe the best interest of very influential actors. And that's, again, where you have to build consensus. You have to build, you can take along someone that might be resistant at first and then get them to become supporters of the idea.
Well, and I think that's also probably where so many of the biggest difficulties, you know, it's one thing to design a brand new city out, quote unquote, in the middle of nowhere, where you can really try to just figure out and integrate everything, as opposed to redesigning something that already exists with that has already vested interests and stakeholders. With Georgia Tech, every year, the master's students in their sort of next to last year are in competition, and we bring in a critic who sets up the studio and frames the issues. And you are this year's Portman Prize critic, and you've got the students. You didn't give them a site. You didn't give them a program. Describe for the listeners, what kind of a studio have you set up and why?
So in your educational journey, you are most often given a site and you're given a program. And I think it's very important as you develop to learn about the different typologies, the different opportunities. You're sometimes given very contrasting kind of needs. I'm right now saying to these graduate students, you've now had that grounding. Now it's kind of time for you to find the challenge that you would like to solve, for you to find a site where you can actually apply that thought process, and then to create either a traditional typology or one of your own making, to, again, infuse in the students a kind of bigness approach, which is saying that don't sit around waiting for someone to call you. Go out there, see the city, see where the challenges are, and offer your own sort of proactive take on how these things can be either improved or. And it's not your own personal thing. I'm also asking the students, go out and meet people, talk to them, because they will most often be the most intelligible and the most thought-provoking. And that we as architects are conduits. We are curators of what the people's needs are. So by being able to select your own site, being able to select your own brief and answer your own challenge, I hope that the students working in teams of two will put in that amount of passion and time and effort, because it's theirs. It's not someone telling them what to do. It's their own thought. So it's entitled Reimagining Social Infrastructure, what we just started the talk with. And it's to look in your backyard, Atlanta, the greater metro area of 10,500 square miles. 10,500 square miles are in the greater Atlanta metro region. And so you got everything. You've got a suburbanized kind of areas. You have wooded and natural, beautiful areas. You have watersheds and creeks that flood. And then you have hard, gritty, kind of asphalted, concreted urbanity. So yeah, the students, they're in teams of two. So they'll probably be about the sort of 37, 38 projects out there.
I am so looking forward to seeing what they produce very quickly. I mean, what types of the ideas that they're working on now are you especially excited about?
I find the students who have looked at and seen that there are true food deserts in Atlanta. There are regions of Atlanta that would shock you that don't have a grocery store. There are areas that may have 40 fast food places to eat, but not one vegetable resource. So if we are to really look at ourselves, if we are to create a healthy future, we need to start with the sustenance. So those students, I think, who are looking at how to create a better food distribution, food infrastructure, those projects should just be built like next, you know, tomorrow. And the same again goes to healthcare. There are students who took GIS mapping, discovered where there hasn't been an investment in healthcare over the last 60 years, and where either, you know, hospitals and care have actually closed down. These are, again, areas that have senior citizens. They have chronic illnesses. They have these people that aren't able to drive to a place or good public transportation connections. These are two areas that I think you should be able to address, and you should be able to find funding, federal funding, state funding, because they just make sense.
And I hope you're holding up the model of Ryan Gravel, our Georgia Tech student whose thesis was the Beltline, a 45-mile conversion of abandoned railway into what is now multi-use trail and is generating incredible investment and health benefits. And again, it was a student idea.
Yeah, so, 1999, master's thesis from Georgia Tech.
I always tell all my urban design students, you know, are you making the next project that will transform Atlanta?
So Ryan, in so many ways, shows what even a student can do. And then Ryan also is seeing how then that idea can morph into ways that were in his vision and are outside of his vision.
Absolutely.
And that sort of political kind of capital that's required to keep that thing going. But the Beltline is an incredible grassroots effort of urbanism, of rethinking, and that health benefit of being able to bike it, bringing people out of their cars, out of their homes. Those are exactly the type of ideas that the Georgia Tech will keep on giving.
Kai Uwe, I can't thank you enough for taking the time to catch up with one of your early teachers. I won't take any credit for the great works that you've accomplished, it is so gratifying. Just see former students so exceeding, and that's not about expectations, but just really making gifts to the world. Podcast listeners, I encourage you again to check out the video of the lecture that Kai Uwe's boss, Bjarke Ingels, gave last month at Georgia Tech. It really was a spectacular event and a great way to see the projects that Kai Uwe and I have been discussing. So thanks to all of you for coming to listen in. You've been listening to Episode 30, Redesigning Cities with Social Infrastructure, the Speedwell Foundation Talk at Georgia Tech. Mm-hmm.